From failure to power, from collaboration to money, from participation to equity,
we want to poke and provoke conversations about the key themes we need to address as urban resilience practitioners, researchers, and policymakers.
Welcome to Urban Resilience Dialogue. I am Chiara.
And I'm Karina.
In our second episode of season 2 of Urban Resilience Dialogues, we are talking about anticipation. We started season 1 by exploring the role of memory in urban resilience. So we are looking forward to explore its counterpart through this keyword, anticipation. Anticipating the future is a practice that goes back millennia, from the Oracle of Delphi, the runes of Norse mythology, and the complex divination system of the I Ching, all the way to modern forecasting technologies and trend monitoring. It seems we've had a long-held fascination about what might happen ahead of us. These practices are also gaining increasing scientific recognition as we are faced with the urgency of the IPCC scenarios and the stark differences between a 1.5 degrees world and the 2.7 degrees we are currently on track for. And in this context, thinking about future pathways for the resilience of our cities is key.
And to explore this all with us, we're joined by Joy Green. Joy is principal futurist at Forum for the Future. She has 14 years of specialist experience practicing futures at Forum with a sustainability and systems lens, contributing to flagship projects by providing expertise in horizon scanning, scenario building, and futures techniques. She's also involved in running the Futures Center, Forum's unique participatory scanning and sense-making platform. Prior to Forum, Joy worked at the pioneering solar power company Solar Century when it was a startup, and at the UK Department for Education as a sustainability advocate. So, Joy, first of all, welcome. Such a pleasure to have you with us today. Can you please tell us a bit about yourself and your journey across the many different disciplines and practices that draw on this fascinating word, anticipation?
Yeah, so really glad to be here. So originally I trained longer in physics, like 20 years ago, and laws of physics are almost, you know, highly applied anticipation, really, when you think about them. But of course, outside the lab in the real world, life is much more complex and unpredictable. And if you want to change the world, which I wanted to do from a sort of young age, you have to be able to embrace uncertainty and actually gain knowledge about how systems work across different disciplines. And I did this by a happy accident, working in urban renewable energy at Solar Century, then as a diver in the Red Sea and education policy. And in each case, I was working either to try to affect the future in some way or in anticipation of a coming change. And then I finally ended up training and working as a futurist at Forum for the Future, where we very intentionally try to affect the future for the better, both through anticipation and imagination. And I've separated those two, actually, because they are separate. So we're sort of anticipating what might be coming. It's often called foresight, but it's also about being creative with that, not being a prisoner of it. So also imagining new possibilities and alternative futures.
For our listeners who might not be as familiar with approaches from futures, foresight, or anticipation, can you share a bit about how these two distinct explorations, so of alternative futures and different imaginaries in general, and specifically of alternative urban futures, have come to overlap in some quite interesting ways?
Yeah, so as soon as you start taking a long-term perspective and you start to explore alternative futures, then cities really show up straight away as a locus for so much change, positive and negative. And there's sort of, you know, so many crazy stats around this, like, you know, it's like, so the world is already urban, mostly urban. That happened, I think, back in 2007. But by 2030, 2 in 3 people will actually be living in cities and almost 1 in 3 in slums. And so on present trends, the future of cities is the future of humanity. So cities are drivers, they're multipliers. They tend to be younger, more experimental spaces where the consequences of what happens are they ripple, they collide, they build on each other, yet good, bad, surprising effects appear very quickly. And you get reinforcing cycles that appear quickly as well, both virtuous and vicious. And then from the government's point of view, cities are really on the front line of many aspects of change, from climate impacts to demographic shifts. And so they really have to be able to anticipate long-term trends if they're going to keep functioning. And especially now, you know, in these decades ahead of us. But they're also a really good scale for change and for more human-centred policy. Like, they are actually really striking how much interesting policy and experiment does happen at city level. You get the sort of really interesting place-based change. I'm thinking here of places like, so Medellin, that used to be the murder capital of the world not that long ago. And some really extraordinary changes happened that were brought about by this experimentation with the cable car system, where they were sort of basically trying to connect the poorer areas of the city to the richer areas. And they decided to use a very, you know, sort of like a completely sort of like experimental cable car system. And it produced all sorts of quite extraordinary effects that eventually helped to basically kind of like remodel the city, really. And then you've got Berlin, which is now sort of they're working through this proposed car ban. It's really interesting. And then, of course, new cities and new urban areas, because cities are always being built and rebuilt, are design opportunities where you can design in new ways of living. And, you know, there's been a long and checkered history of people using cities as living design experiments, like trying out new ways and really building in like new lifestyles. And you can really quickly create and imagine alternative pathways in cities because of this, sort of this churn, this experimentation. And you know, and big powerful cities do tend to recognise this. And so like Singapore is sort of well known for actually having a very long-term planning process that uses future scenarios because they've internalised this reality and they try to sort of run with it.
So I wanted to connect with this planning process we're talking about. And in a way, architecture and urbanism have had their fair share of imagined futures. And especially often they have been very technology driven. But thinking about the city of the future is not only the privilege of architects and urbanists. I mean, I'm thinking about fiction writers, filmmakers, artists that give us like a lot of materials to imagine the future of our cities. And thinking about it, I have many more examples of dystopian cities. I'm thinking of Los Angeles as a full control metropolis in Blade Runner, or New York in The Fifth Element as this vertical city saturated with flying vehicles and smog, where we don't even see the streets anymore. It's much harder for me to think of positive, sustainable, green, just good depiction of future cities that are not highly technological. Why do you think that might be?
That's a really good question. And I think part of it is because science fiction is so influential culturally. You know, all these examples you gave, they're from science fiction. And it very naturally does tend to skew dystopian because there's a strong emphasis on technology and on the unintended social and political consequences of new technology. And this is partly related to after World War II, a sort of kind of loss of innocence occurred in the West around ideas of technological progress. You know, after sort of nuclear bombs, people started to, this dark side started to become apparent. And this loss of innocence actually keeps being repeated sort of almost every generation. And most recently we had it with internet and social media. In the 90s, it was this amazing thing that was going to connect us all together. And now it's like this really kind of like quite dark reality of manipulation. And so we've had this sort of, you know, this repeated cycle. And so if you have a highly technological vision, it does tend to be dark because we have learned there's often a significant shadow side to new technology if it's unrestrained. And cities have been the testing ground for technology since the Industrial Revolution. So there is a natural modern association between the two. But it hasn't always been the case. And if you look at other times and other cultures, cities have had other associations, perhaps more interesting ones. And I'm thinking here of sort of ancient sacred cities, for example, which were, you know, a lot of them over the sort of, I guess, millennia. And they were purposefully designed to help people encounter the transcendent and live in relation to it. And there's a good example now that still sort of works at Isfahan in Iran. And there's an interesting question here, which is what is sacred in modern cities? It's a very important question because the values and the priorities for the future visions of these cities will flow from that answer. And if you look at a modern city, the default answer, you know, what is the city for? What is sacred? It's actually economic growth, because modern cities are revered as economic powerhouses for capitalism. Another aspect, while they, you know, so recognize as important, they remain secondary to that. But if you want visions of sustainable and just future cities, you need a different answer to that central question. You know, what are cities for? What are they really for? What is sacred? You need a different answer to that question.
Wow, that is a huge question. And I feel like to me, it brings such a different lens to look at some of the concepts that in this bubble of resilience practitioners, that short phrases that have become the norm, like build back better or bouncing back or good growth or green growth. And I think, yeah, this question of what is really sacred, I think that is a key sort of lens to bring and really kind of interrogate this a bit more. And I guess bridging from this issue of utopian and dystopian depictions of future cities, I want us to dig us a bit deeper into how we might use some of these methods to shape present action when it comes to urban resilience more specifically. And in this world of urban resilience, we really see two trends. So on one hand, cities and urban practitioners are increasingly using foresight methods to inform interventions and policy. And then on the other hand, there's an emerging practice area of using anticipatory measures such as forecast-based financing, forecast-based action, early warning, early action measures. There's a lot of forecasting involved in this. And what both these trends are underpinned by is a bit of a predict and plan view of how the world works. So my question to you is, how can we move away from this bias, perhaps, of quantitative, predictive modeling, and really expand the focus of what does urban anticipatory practices really look like that can help build our capacities to imagine those alternatives that you were mentioning at the beginning, to explore different trade-offs and to really inspire real transformative change? And perhaps I wonder if it's not too much of a stretch. I wonder if you know of any examples or stories of cities that are doing this.
It's a really, really interesting question, because of course you do need some forecasting, like, you know, the world we live in, but it's also really important not to be trapped by it. There is a, you know, if you rely too much on it and on extrapolation, there's a sort of illusion of certainty that's created, especially with the advent of AI, because, you know, it's, we have these numbers, but we're now actually in turbulent, volatile times where quite clearly predict and plan approaches are quite easily disrupted and thrown into complete disarray. I'm thinking particularly about global shipping. That is, you know, very much just in time, predict and plan system, and it is not coping at all with the current challenges. You know, one from small disruptions have led to very, you know, cascading consequences. So in turbulent times, the other thing to bear in mind is that if you're focusing like kind of almost entirely on forecasting and foresight, that tends to skew negative if you're doing it properly, because there are so many risks to consider. Actually terrifying risks, actually, if you really sort of like doing a really good job scanning. And you can really easily get stuck in this sort of extrapolation. It's basically a dark version of today. And it also doesn't engage very deeply with trade-offs, because when you're sort of stuck in this sort of future, that is like the official future, really, you can feel like there's no alternative. We're stuck with patching up this dysfunctional system that's slowly falling apart. We just have to suck up some pretty awful outcomes, or we have to push them onto others in a zero-sum way. But there are always alternatives. There are always several possible futures, and the future does remain inherently unpredictable, no matter how much data you have in your model, because the level of complexity and chaos and nonlinear feedbacks is so high in the real world that models, you know, models will never, like, so the map is never the territory. And actually, if you engage with this reality in a qualitative and imaginative way, that actually tends to be more fruitful, especially if you marry it with insights from systems thinking. So I'll explain a little bit more. So there are many ways of creating alternative futures. And the most interesting ones, in my view, are the ones that really unearth deep assumptions and that allow you to explore what happens when basic goals of systems are reset and values are different. They use a systems approach to explore powerful what-if questions. So like that question I mentioned earlier, what is a city really for? What is sacred? So what might the answer be to that question? What might it have shifted to by 2030? By 2035, by 2040, in response to the anticipated pressures of the coming decades, and what future visions might flow from different answers to that question? Because there are many different answers to that question. Are there seeds of those alternative futures and different answers to that question around today? Because there are always little bits of futures, isn't there? There's a really famous William Gibson quote that everyone who does futures knows, which is that the future's already here, just not very well distributed. But this is really true. It really is. There really are. You know, there's seeds of, like, you know, five or six different, like, wherever you look. It's just a question of sort of like opening your eyes a bit. So in terms of cities doing this now, I think this is a slight sort of answer to your question, sort of not. But I think, so Amsterdam is doing something really interesting right now, where they're exploring how to be a donut city. And this is with reference to donut economics, which I assume people have a basic understanding of what that is. So they've come up with a new answer to that question. They've decided their city is fundamentally for enabling their citizens to live within the donut, which means giving everyone a good quality of life while remaining within real environmental limits. which sounds deceptively simple, but it's actually pretty radical if you put it properly into practice, because it really involves a lot. It involves naming and fully costing all its externalities. It involves being really clear about the trade-offs that are happening, often renegotiating them in the light of, you know, in the light of this new goal. And they basically brought this new goal to direct their infrastructure projects, employment schemes, their policies for government contracts, as well as inspiring hundreds of grassroots programmes. And there are even effects on the price of everyday groceries. So, you know, groceries, if you go to a corner shop and you buy like a courgette, has to be true price. It has to show you how they accounted for impacts like the carbon footprint, the toll of the farming on the land, the fair pay for the workers. Where's the costing for that? You see it in the price of, you know, when you're buying it. So this is a really great example of surfacing the trade-offs that previously happened invisibly off stage. And so I think that's, I mean, it's almost their living, their alternative future, rather than just describing it. But it's a really interesting example.
By mentioning the Amsterdam example, it's a good way to go through our next questions, like, which is, how do we do to go from scenarios to action? Because we couldn't talk about anticipation without discussing the power of scenarios as a tool to prepare, and more importantly, choose a path, a strategy to move forward. Of course, there is one particular set of scenarios that are coming to my mind right now, and it is the IPCC scenarios on greenhouse gas emissions used to make projections of possible future climate change. They are regularly updated, but the range of possible futures will have huge implications depending if we are looking at 1.5 or 4 degrees of global temperature increase. This is when we circle back to the challenge of urban resilience, as many of our cities around the world are already feeling the effect of climate change. So my question to you is, how can we best use scenarios to inform action when there are so many uncertainties?
So scenarios are really a great tool, and they're obviously really useful for exploring possible future climate change impacts. And they can also be really good to help explore possible responses, because of course there's a really wide range of possible responses that we can have as humans, like really wide, from like inaction, doing nothing, which was sort of, you know, you've tried that for a bit, regenerative approaches, technical geoengineering, and whichever, yeah, and many more as well. That's the sort of like that's the ones I'm describing the range. But whichever approach dominates, will shape the future that we get in fundamental ways, because of course, climate is not just about energy, it's about the food we eat, about how we move around, how we produce everything. And really, it's actually about the nature of our relationship with this living planet and all the other living beings on it, both human and non-human. And so with qualitative scenarios, you can create and immerse in quite complex pictures of the future that draw many factors, and they allow you to explore different possible answers to these questions in depth. You know, what happens if, you know, if we look at a future world where the response is majored around, you know, regenerative natural resources versus one that's really gone heavy on geoengineering versus one that, you know, that's done something else. You can push things to extremes. You can really explore like what are the second and third order consequences that start to emerge. So scenarios are good at dealing with uncertainties in general, as long, and this is a sort of technical bit here, as long as you can identify a small group of critical uncertainties to use for framing. And that's the key. So you do occasionally get situations of discontinuity where the number of critical uncertainties basically goes through the roof. And that's what happened last year. We had the pandemic, you know. So we had the end of the pandemic, the global lockdowns came really into play, and then base normality ceased, you know, pretty abruptly, so abruptly for most of us. The oil price went negative. We were suddenly confined to our homes. And in this kind of situation, that's that unprecedented, the scenarios can't really cope with the level of uncertainty in play, and you have to use different tools.
And I also wonder if you can share some thoughts or practices for spotting things that are changing. What wildcrafts keep you up at night currently?
Yeah, well, we live in really interesting times, I think, in that sort of in the nature of that Chinese curse, and a great deal of shifting, unraveling and recreating. And the challenge now is not really so much how to spot things that are changing, but how to make sense of the blizzard of signals and information. Like, so much is changing, so much is happening. It's how do you make sense of all? It really helps to have a basic systemic framework to help make sense of what you are seeing. And so at Forum, we use trajectories, there's another thing called three horizons, or we can even think of dynamic areas, but some way of like organizing what you're seeing and interpreting it systemically. The other thing to bear in mind is that we now very much live in algorithmically curated bubbles. So you need to find ways to leave your bubble, or your information will be very lopsided. So you have to find sources from other parts of the political spectrum. You have to be curious, be a magpie. And the really key thing to do is to diversify your network of not just sources, but of people that you're sort of getting, that you're talking to and learning from as much as possible. It's the edges, not just the mainstream. And I think this used to be a lot easier a few years ago, actually. There's also something about, now we're in these kind of like this more optimized sort of screen-based reality. It is harder to do that, but it's really important. Because the more diverse you get, the bigger the range of possibilities you can cover. And when you're scanning, it's not just about technology. Like, there's a real sort of strong technological determinism strand in futures that is frankly unhelpful, because actually the social, the political, the environmental and economic changes are really key. And it's really important to understand the systemic context that changes are happening in. And I guess what keeps me up at night is the current level of systemic fragility, because so many systems have become so brittle now that it doesn't take much to disrupt them and cause cascading consequences. And just this year, we've seen some really disproportionate consequences from really quite small events. And you can even see the pandemic in this light. Someone ate an infected bat, and global systems were so unable to respond that 2/3 of the world ended up having to go into lockdown. So the world needs to become basically much more resilient and flexible to cope with turbulence, but the opposite seems to be happening at the moment. And in this brittle context, that means that the number of potential wildcards increases sharply. Things that wouldn't normally be wildcards before start to become them, because they can disrupt systems that are easy to disrupt.
We hear you, and I think this is well shared, like common preoccupations, and connecting to this theme of uncertainties and wildcards in the systems modeling that Donella Meadows, we are big fans, by the way, was doing at MIT all the way back in the 70s. One recurring finding was coming out that in all the model runs of future scenarios, the world didn't run out of resources or food, but it ran out of coping capacity. This has become a key term in urban resilience, and I wonder if we can unpack this a bit. What are your thoughts on these coping capacities and how we might expand our bandwidth for that? And very importantly, how do we not just cope, but adapt and transform?
I mean, so coping, adapting and transforming are obviously really important areas to focus attention on, because it also needs to focus attention on what's going wrong. So focusing on what's going right is an important skill to learn. And signals, seize this resilient future can actually be really helpful here, because there is actually a lot happening here to learn from. I mean, from like what's happening in Bangladesh. So Bangladesh has been very aware, it's been on the front line of flooding for like some time. They've put in some really interesting systems, like quite ingenious ones, like to sort of minimize the impact, to help people deal with it, and to recover quite quickly. I mean, last year the country's underwater and they've recovered. It's quite extraordinary. Then you have like the Kurds in Rojava, another really extraordinary story. The still ongoing Syrian civil war, but like they created basically a sort of an eco-feminist society in the middle of a civil war. Really extraordinary what they did there. I'm not sure the status of it now after the invasion of Turkey, but for a few years it was quite an extraordinary beacon of like, this should not be happening in this extraordinary, in the worst possible conditions, and yet humans are still able to sort of like create these extraordinary responses. And then Amsterdam's own approach that we talked about. So that there is a lot to be aware of and to learn from. And there's also something about the mindset that we need to sort of like, we need to dig into a bit, because I think particularly here in the West, we've been very used to dealing with a much calmer world. In the rich countries, since the middle of the 20th century, we've been sailing very smoothly on a sort of quite calm river. And we're no longer on that planet now. Like Bill McKibben talks about, I don't have to pronounce it, but it's like Earth with an extra in the middle. And by that, he means we've created a new planet, a new planetary context. We've created it, we're still creating it, which has a much more extreme climate, has much more volatility, to an extent that we haven't probably seen for the last few thousand years. But we have to live in this context now. And to do that, we have to recognize that particularly as Westerners, a lot of our previous experience assumptions are actually probably no longer helpful. And we need to to learn to be more humble, more willing to learn from cultures that already cope with volatility. Because around the world, many cultures already do cope with quite extreme situations. They've learned how to do that. And we also probably need to reimagine what a good life is, to center what really is important to human thriving, and to figure out how to keep creating that and providing that for each other within that donut. And it's very clear now that consumerism is running out of road and we need to let it go. But frankly, it wasn't great for quality of life anyway. And we also need to let go of the other things. This is important. We need to let go of the apocalyptic fantasies that we've sort of been accidentally nurturing in our popular culture over the last few decades, because they also are not helpful and not actually realistic depictions of what does happen when there's a crisis. Because whatever happens, life does go on. Life will go on. People love, they fight, they carry on being human. And humans are inherently very adaptable, very responsive and very inventive. And the task is sort of, how do we draw these traits in the right way? And if we can, then a great deal is still possible.
I really love that reflection. And I think there's something that comes up for me around, like, how do we move away from this almost like this imagination scarcity? And like, how do we create that abundance in the things that we can and the things that we can allow ourselves to imagine? And I think it was really interesting during the pandemic, like, you know, we've become so used to these like apocalyptic, you know, end of the world scenarios that in a way, everything that was happening around us was so extraordinary. And yet in the very simple, the very small, the very mundane ways, like life still went on, you know, like you were still annoyed at your partner because of this, and you still were annoyed at your parents because of that, and you still had to take the bins out. And in, you know, like in some ways, like life really goes on, even when you're living in these like extraordinary situations. And I guess this sort of reflection really segues quite nicely into our next theme, where we wanted to explore a bit more around how do we increase our own capability to anticipate, to imagine alternatives. And here there's two parts to my question. So first, this challenge of who gets to imagine these futures, especially when for the people and the communities who are already experiencing either protracted crisis or marginalization or climate risks or climate vulnerabilities, there is very little capacity to project beyond the present tense. So how do we ensure that that capacity of imagining futures is not just for the privileged, and also that we avoid that trap of technology will save us? And the second part of my question is around how might we be able to build these either scaffolding or infrastructure to enable us to imagine and anticipate at scale, really. So what you were talking about earlier, like how do we kind of, you know, let go of consumerism? How do we kind of bring about that imagination abundance from individuals, our teams, our communities, our organizations as well as at a whole society level? And anticipation is becoming a new buzzword. So I'd really love your thoughts on these two key questions, because I feel like we're at a very interesting point in where this word might go going forward.
So I suppose it's back to that point again about looking for those seeds of resilient futures today, because some of those seeds are in marginalized communities, and we do need to get serious about learning from them. And not just learning from them, but also learning with them as partners, because there are some really very different worldviews out there. And I'm thinking especially of the Indigenous worldviews that underlie, you know, the rights of nature movement you've probably heard of, which is, you know, where, you know, rivers have rights, forests have rights, and they're starting to be enacted now, actually. So the Magpie River in Quebec recently became recognised as a person. And this represents a really completely different relationship to nature. If a river has personhood, if it has rights, yeah, if you build this out legally, it points to really quite a radically different future vision, where a forest or river has rights that can't be compromised or offset, because you can't offset a person. You know, you can't go, well, we'll just offset this person, you can have this new one over here. You can't do that with a person. A river has the right to flow. It's not being policed. It means that you can't, you know, you can't dump chemicals in it. You probably can't build a dam across it. And the ramifications are really quite far-reaching if you follow them through as to what the shift in relationship that happens and what that means for like how humans actually engage. Like extractivism becomes very difficult under that, for example. But it's not just about Indigenous communities who, you know, who've been getting a lot of attention recently. There are many other marginalised communities to be reached as well. And I think perhaps the key word here is agency, and about how we enable agency. And what really came to mind with this question was this sort of really fascinating example of a community-led solar city that was started in Uganda recently. So what happened? There was an ex-aid worker who was Ugandan, Ojukwu Okello. He'd worked for years with international NGOs, and he'd become quite disillusioned because time and again he'd seen projects fail. And in his view, it's because there was a persistent exclusion of communities from decisions about their own future. They weren't allowed to basically make decisions about funding, about what actually happened. Things were done to them. And that meant that, you know, things never really took. They'd go for a bit and then they would fail. So he got tired of it and he returned a few years ago to his own ancestral village in Uganda, which had been in an area that previously had had civil war and was trying to recover. And he set up a social enterprise to develop it, but to develop it in a community-led way. And the model he developed has led to really quite rapid and sustainable development in this sort of 2 years since 2019. So there's now solar electricity for all, there's clean water, there's an investment club for local farmers and business owners, there's a community clinic, there's a school that takes payments in local pubs as well as cash. And these are all ideas that came from the community themselves. And the community, you know, and they built on it, and there's sort of energy around all these initiatives, and the people have decided because the local shear trees are a kind of important resource, but also endangered species, and so they protect them and regenerate them, but also use them as a source of sustainable income. So you've got their community basically, you know, coming up with solutions to the same problems and building on them, and you know, and they've been given agency, and so this the key factors seem to be giving people agency in decisions about their own community. And, you know, in participatory budgeting, we've seen, you know, in Porto Alegre and many places that have been experiments in participatory budgeting. And that seems to confirm this. Where there's a link to a real world local outcome, people do engage well, you do get this sort of cumulative effect. And Taiwan is really interesting because they've been doing this at a national scale. And really interesting because they've been doing it, you know, like in the face of a lot of disinformation from China, when everyone else has been sort of just dealing with social media, social breakdown, they've managed to create a bit of sort of consensus building digital platform that, you know, that generates basically policy suggestions for the nation. So that's fascinating to look at as well. And even here in the UK, you've got citizen assemblies that are producing, you know, helpful policy suggestions that have been really kind of quite deeply thought through. And I think that if you're going to have a community anticipation infrastructure, you basically need to learn from these approaches. And one of the learnings is that if you're going to ask people to take part and to anticipate, you have to ground it into real world output for the community, something that will change as a result. You know, whether it's policy or experiment pilot, something that is sort of that people can see a result. And even at Forum, when we do features works, we tend that they always, we always at the end of the project say, bring it back to the present. What does this mean for now? What is going to change as a result of this project? Because if you could say that, you know, gathering insights for communities, because perhaps it's a bit like gathering nectar. You need to turn it into honey. You need to give it back to the community and to close the loop. Because if you don't do that, it becomes easy for it to degenerate into something that's a bit empty, a bit cynical. People have a sense for that. And it's really hard to do this. You know, it's like it's easier, much easier said than done. But I think it is essential. Like if you're serious about like actually like, you know, large scale and anticipation and really getting people to participate.
Wow, thank you. Loads of takeaways in there around like, how do we actually start this? Like, how do we build this infrastructure for ourselves? And thank you for such a whirlwind of a conversation. I feel like we've explored so many different things. And before we wrap up, we have one final question, and it's, you know, more of a playful one. And if you were to send us a postcard from the future, so maybe, I don't know, let's say 20 years from now, what would you write on it? And what would the image on it be of?
I'd really love to send a postcard from a world that's regenerating, that's adapting, that's rising to challenge, because I think it is possible. I think that world is very possible and it is in touch and distance. And like those seeds of those possible futures, I'd like to see what one has grown into. Maybe from that says it's in Uganda, what has it grown into? what have all these initiatives like borne fruit, and how has it grown? And I'd like to be able to say, you know, that that alternative world is possible, that, you know, we are living it.
Joy, thank you so much for everything, for unpacking with us the complexity of working with future scenarios and the power it can have on impacting our choices on building a better society through anticipation. And as you said, imagination. I'm thinking how empowering it is to remind ourselves that we do have alternative futures available ahead, and that we can and should engage in building the future of our society around this beautiful flagship question: what is sacred? Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Urban Resilience Dialogues. We are Karina Angeloyu and Chiara Tomaselli.
Want to get in touch with us? Drop us a line at urbanresiliencedialogues@gmail.com or you can tweet us
with the hashtag #URDialogues.
Chat to you soon.